This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When she guest hosted The Tonight Show, she never invited me on. When she had her own show on Fox, you didn't see me on there either. Now she's got an Emmy Award-winning talk show. Still, no invitation. But I've invited Joan Rivers to be a guest on Fresh Air, because that's the kind of person I am. Joan Rivers has a new memoir called Still Talking, and it's given me the chance to talk with her. The book covers everything from how she writes jokes to how she survived the most difficult period of her life. After her husband Edgar's suicide, Rivers was devastated. It was 5 months before she went back on stage. She told me what that first night was like. After all, so many of her jokes had been about Edgar.
It was very difficult. They didn't know. I was hanging over the audience. It was hanging up. Her husband killed himself. She was fired from the Fox network. She's finished. She's over. She's not funny. I really think they came to look. And tremendous tension. And I was very nervous. And I figured, you might as well go. It was the way I've handled my whole life. Go out and just talk about it from the beginning. And instead of waiting till the end to talk about it, I walked out and talked about it at the start and made them laugh. And that cleared the air. And I thought to myself, oh, thank you, God. I can continue as a comedian.
So what kinds of things did you say about Edgar or the suicide in your act?
Well, you have to deal with it. I mean, these people were not stupid. I said, my husband killed himself, as you all know, and he asked to be cremated and have his ashes sprinkled in Neiman Marcus, because then he knew I would visit him every day. And they laughed. And that was the only reference I made to it. And it was just fine. It was just enough.
Now, you say that your audience didn't want you to be sexual when you went back to comedy.
No.
What kinds of jokes weren't going over?
I'm not a sexual person, certainly on stage. And they loved hearing about my sex life when I was married. They didn't want to see a 52-year-old woman at that point talking about dating. And they just didn't want to hear. And there was one joke, which is so indicative. I had written this joke saying, I don't think I'm good in bed. I said to a man last night, why don't you call out my name while we're making love? And he said, I don't want to wake you up. And that got such a gasp from the audience. So I changed the joke to say, I don't think I was good in bed when I was married. I once said to my husband, why don't you call out my name while we're making love? And he said, I don't want to wake you up. And it got a big response. And I realized right then and there they didn't want to hear dating jokes or any kind of any innuendo about sex for me currently. Not that there was any, but you know, you write these jokes. But you write these jokes, you know, you come up, well, I'll do a whole thing on going out with a man, he tries to make out with me, you know, something like that. Or I try to make out with him. And I realized they didn't want to hear that from me.
Now, so much of your material over the years has been about how you look, you know, about feeling unattractive, about being too heavy, about not being sexy. Yet for years, your onstage look has been positively glamorous. You have gorgeous clothes. You're incredibly thin. You've gone through plastic surgery. You look terrific. So does it ever feel like the material is out of sync with who you really are, who you've really become?
No. Everybody tries to look. I don't know one person listening out there gets up in the morning and says, I think I'm going to pick the ugliest outfit and I'm going to try to look really unattractive today. We all try to look the best we can, and I've just done the best I can with this package, you know? But I diet all the time, and I try to look good, and the wrinkles are coming on, and no, I don't look hot at all. I look good for what I started out as, but that's it. So it doesn't, and they look at me on stage, and they go, yeah, she's right, she is a pig. There's no question about that.
So your self-image is still in keeping with the kinds of jokes you tell about
yourself?
Oh,
yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you still tell jokes about being heavy?
I get on a scale twice a day, and I am still heavy. I've seen myself in a bathing suit. This is not thin, you know, skinny mini over here. My thighs, a family of 18 could live on them for a year if you put ketchup on them.
I see. I think that's a very funny joke, but I look at you and I think, you know, you're seeing somebody different in the mirror than who you really are.
I hope so. I hope so. Because what I see in the mirror, boy, I don't like.
Well, why did being overweight and feeling, that you weren't attractive have such a profound effect on you?
Well, I think it has a profound effect on everybody. When I mean, when they write in your yearbook, here comes Fat Fat the water rat, you don't forget that. That ruins your yearbook. You don't forget it when you come down the stairs at college and a blind date says out loud to the guy standing next to him, why didn't you tell me? These are things that scar you very, very deeply. And stay that way, you know, that's it.
How did you feel about the recent TV Guide cover story on celebrity plastic surgery? And the cover had a before and after picture of you on it.
I don't get plastic surgery. Celebrities will tell you they were raped by their mothers, they were beaten, incest. I mean, they will tell you the most. One comedian, you know, would say how her parents took excrement and put it all over her, you know? And you say to them, did you have a face of, what, me? Never. I don't know. And everybody has done it. And I just think people should, see, tell the truth. What is so terrible to say, I want to look better, and I had my nose thinned. I want to look better, and yes, I mean, Jane Fonda, who was into exercise, as we all know, has had the facelift, has had the boobs done, has had God knows what, and that's fine. Why are we playing this game? I don't get it. So I was delighted to come out and say to my audience, I'm going in now because my eyes look like hell, and I'm getting a really bad under-the-chin look. Delighted to do it.
I'll tell you the problem I have with plastic surgery, and tell me what you think of it. I think that we're just creating this just impossible ideal. And I think of, like, the young Joan Rivers who was uncomfortable with how she looked. Imagine if she felt she had to live up to
the kind
of body and face that could only be created by surgeons.
Let me just tell you something, and it's very nice to say, and I'm already bored to death. Let me just tell you something. We're in a business where you have to look good.
Yeah.
Where they fire people because they're getting old. And it's very easy to say, let's grow old. The public doesn't want to see an old puss giving the news, and you know it, and talk to Jane Pauley at 40.
So you feel that you really have no choice.
There is no choice in our business. There is no choice. We didn't want to see Elizabeth Taylor jowly and horrible. We're thrilled to see her looking good again. We're thrilled to see Sophia Loren looking beautiful. I mean, who are we kidding?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Rivers. She's got a new memoir called Still Talking. I was interested to read about the working method that you developed early on for writing your jokes. You said that you can't just sit down and write jokes.
Yeah.
You needed to, like, work off somebody. So you used to have Rodney Dangerfield come over.
Yes, we were all very young in those days.
So tell me how you would work together, what the process was like.
Process is just, I come out of Second City, which is all, you know, verbal. And we would sit and just start saying, okay, answering machine. Let's do jokes on answering machines. Well, okay, my answering machine, I'm so boring, my answering machine doesn't even pick up. No, that's not good enough. Okay, let's do an answering machine. Answering. All right, how about, I'm so boring, my answering machine put me on hold. Good. I mean, you just keep, the process is you just bounce on one another, till you find something you like.
So Rodney Dangerfield was somebody good to bounce off of.
Wonderful. He was wonderful. Another man named Marshall Brickman, who wrote all the early Woody Allen movies with Woody, who's now writing himself and directing himself. Marshall was a joy, because you would come in and sit and laugh till you found something good.
Have you ever had people writing for you?
Oh, of course. And anyone out there that thinks they're funny, please send me some jokes. I pay $10 for every joke that I use.
Gee, that's not a lot.
It is when I buy the joke and pay for it before I've even tested it. I think out of 100...
Oh, you mean like if I sent
like
you any lousy old thing, you'd pay
$10. They send me like a bunch of jokes. And I'll say, oh, let me think I'll try this one. I think I'll try four. So I'll send them a check for $40. Then I take those four jokes and try them out. And if you're lucky, one joke out of 15 works. One joke out of 20 works. One joke out of 100 really works. It's very hard. Everyone sees different ideas of what is funny. And when I write jokes myself and they don't work, it's very hard for me because I think, but that's funny. Why aren't you laughing?
When you were subbing for Carson, did his writers write any of your opening monologues?
No, because his writers would, and they're right, and they were right, would give me the jokes they didn't want to give Johnny, which means Johnny got the good jokes. Johnny was paying them. If you write a brilliant joke, who are you going to give it to?
Right.
The guy that's paying you or the girl that comes in once a week who has nothing to do with your life or your future? So they didn't give me good jokes. So I would come in with my own.
Well, also, there's something so much, like from a woman's point of view about your jokes. I'm sure all of us writers, or certainly at least most of them, were men.
And again, the funniest jokes, of course, come from me. Mm-hmm. It truly ends up what I think is funny. My perception of something always is the strongest in my act.
When you started to perform, did you look up to the few women who were in the field, like Phyllis Diller, Toni Field, Selma Diamond?
No. I never think in terms of comedy male or female oriented. I looked at Lenny Bruce because he told the truth. Mm-hmm. He told the truth. And as a very impressionable young woman then right out of college, the first time I saw him, I went, but he's saying what I'm thinking. Maybe not with those words, because in those days you just didn't say the words that he said. But he's saying what I'm thinking, and that's what I want to say on stage.
What was your early material like before you'd really kind of developed the Joan Rivers persona?
Very shocking in those days. I played my first record, which really was my successful record for 1966, called Mr. Phyllis and Other Stories, which was about my hairdresser. And I played it for Melissa, and the record in those days was like, did you hear what this girl has in a record? I mean, you know, they didn't even know my name at that point. And my daughter and I said, isn't that sweet? In 1966, to say you were having an affair with a married man, and while he was engaged to me, his wife became pregnant, which is one of my jokes. So I don't think, my joke was, while he became engaged to me, his wife became pregnant, so I don't think he's sincere, was my joke. This shocked audiences. And my daughter and I said, isn't that cute? So what was shocking then is not shocking now. But I was always shocking within the framework of the time period.
When you started off, it was before you were married to Edgar. You'd been married once before. So did you have a guy in your life to do jokes about? You know, did you have like a name to use?
I had
a person.
I was having this affair with this college professor from Columbia, who indeed was married at the time, separated but nonetheless married. And so I used that, and I used all the jokes which were true about dating. And my mother was crazy. She had two of us that weren't moving, as the expression goes. And I talked about that a lot. And my sister graduated from Columbia Law School at 21, was very pretty and nothing. And my mother would just, no matter what happened, you know, and I talked about in the act, if you saw an accident, my mother would say, that means a wedding. You know, she was always looking for, a man would be decapitated, the head would roll to my mother's feet. My mother would go, this means a wedding, this means a good. So that's what I talk. I always talk from truth. You know, I think that's very important for your act, that they know, even though there's a joke there, that you really mean what you're saying.
You're just joining us. My guest is Joan Rivers, and she's written a new memoir called Still Talking. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Joan Rivers is my guest. She has a new memoir called Still Talking. What was it like the first time you played Vegas?
Very frightening. I was so stupid. Again, it's all in the book. I thought Vegas was the desert, and I went out there for Thanksgiving, and I brought bathing suits and shorts. I mean, and it's cold. And they didn't know me, and I didn't know them, and I had brought a little black dress, and I spent the whole night with this wonderful woman named Ann Pierce, the dresser, pasting sequins on this dress to look like it came from, you know, the right place. Very hard at the beginning to play Vegas.
You say that it gave you a different perspective on the people who've lasted there for years. What did you start to respect about, like, the quintessential Vegas performers that you didn't respect before?
Well, you know, we all say, to this day, people call me when they don't like me, and there's a review. It'll always start out with Joan Rivers, comma, Vegas, comma, or Vegas performer, comma. And I went with the same snotty attitude, and my husband was so smart in so many ways. He said to me, these people have been around. Dean Martin's been around for 30 years. Before you get so snotty, go and see why. Go and look at Wayne Newton. And he would take me every night after my show to go and see the other performers. And I learned the magic of these old war horses, the energy that comes from these people, the incredible presence of these stars, these true Vegas performers, a wonderful. They're the backbone of our business. And boy, did I learn from that give all and the love that went back and forth with the audience. Tremendous learning process for me. I adored doing Vegas by the end of it. I was proud. you know, you turn the corner after my husband Edgar had died, and I couldn't work for so long. And then I went back, as we talked about, you know, to Las Vegas. And to turn the corner and see your name in lights 10 feet tall, and you think, I'm back, and it's wonderful.
How did you start doing celebrity jokes as part of your material? Yeah, you know, especially like Liz Taylor, you know, dishing the celebrities.
How can you not? Elizabeth Taylor was on the cover of People magazine looking like a house. It was like and no one said anything. I went on the Carson show and said, did you see People magazine? Looks like Elizabeth Taylor ate her last two husbands. And the audience went insane. It was like someone saying the emperor's not wearing clothes. You know, it was that simple. And from then on, I said, just say what you say in private to your friends. Because that we all get on the phone with our friends and we all dish about people. You know that. We all know that.
Oh, not me.
Not me. Right. And that's how it started with all the jokes.
What's your attitude toward this on your own talk show? Because you have on a lot of celebrities now. Are you afraid of dishing them?
I just let my talk show, I'm so happy with, and I'm so pleased with how well it's doing. I just let the chips fall where they may. And people, I think, now know me so well. They say, oh, that's just Joan.
But, you know, a lot of times when you're talking to a celebrity or actress, whatever, I mean, they've come on to talk about being victimized or secret problems they've had to overcome. So is it going to make them hard? Is it going to make it harder for you to dish them the next time? You know, when they've come on the show to expose their sensitive side?
No, and everyone's got a sensitive side. And it's wonderful when you see that come out in an interview. I always love that when you get someone like a Carol Burnett, who was on very, very recently. And when she talked about being lonely, it was terrific to have Carol Burnett sitting there saying, I'd love to meet somebody. I'd love to have somebody in my life. That was a terrific moment.
If you're just joining us, Joan Rivers is my guest, and her new memoir is called Still Talking. You write in your book that there was a point when you realized that your husband Edgar no longer really belonged in your life, that you had really different needs, and you were really involved with your career. You liked being on stage, and things were just moving too fast for him, and then he got into real problems with the Fox show. He was kind of the lightning rod for...
He was the one that... He was, you know, because he was having mental problems, he was the one that anything that went wrong, they can blame it on him. You know what I'm saying. He was it, as they say. And it was a very difficult time. It was very difficult for me because I was defending my husband and protecting my husband and trying to keep the show going and dealing with people at Fox, many of whom I felt were totally and totally incompetent. It was a rotten period of my life.
You say in your book that there was a period where you felt that you were somehow responsible for a suicide, but you know,
oh, yeah.
Much later you said to yourself, well, Edgar killed Edgar.
Yeah.
He killed himself. What was the turning point for you in starting to think of it that way?
Again, I work so hard for suicide prevention now and with suicide survivors because you feel the guilt. At one point, you just have to say to yourself, it was his choice. And at that point in his life, that was what he did. And I could not have saved him. But it's a long road coming to say that, coming to believe it yourself. And I still half times don't believe it. I still think maybe one more phone call would have done it. But he had to go into I couldn't help him. You reach a point, you've got to know when you say in your life, with relationships, I can't help this anymore. We need an outsider to come in and help us. And that's what I had said to him. I said, you must go for help. I cannot do this anymore.
A little earlier, you talked about how when you started performing again after your husband's suicide, you felt kind of insecure that people would look at you and say, oh, she's been the victim of tragedy. And it would make it hard for them to see you as a comic. Do you think that your new book will bring back some of that or lessen that effect?
I don't know. I think what I would like the book to do, you know, it was wonderful. I thought God has only done this to me. You know, why? It was like Job, why? Why is this happening? Why is this happening? Why? I mean, everything. The end of Carson, I was treated so badly. And then the Fox thing, and then Edgar's heart attack, and Edgar's suicide, and my daughter and my relationship crumbled, and I couldn't get work. And it was like, what now, God? What now, God? And I had to put down two dogs the same week that my husband, killed himself. It was just horrendous. And then as I would talk to, I went to a therapy group, And this woman walked in. I thought, oh, and looking so good, all Chanel and pearls and hairdo. And I thought, oh, yeah, honey, what have you been through? You know, I'm here because I'm miserable. What are you? And she began to talk, and her husband and two children had been killed in a plane crash. And I suddenly realized everybody's gone through something, and everybody has to come out of it, and we have to help each other. And I think that's what the book is about. It's showing for all of us you must get through, and you can get through.
So tell me, is there a man in your life now?
No, no, but that's okay. That's fine. You can't have everything. And I woke up the other morning, I thought, thank you, God, my daughter is well and beautiful and doing well on her own, which every parent worries about. And I've got a show, and we're doing just fine. And I've got very good friends. And it's okay to end up like this.
Well, it's not over.
No,
you're not
but
ending up. Or...
this is where I'm going to be for the next 10 years. That's fine.
Well, I guess you feel pretty independent about it, too.
Yeah. Oh, of course. And I'm on my own. I stand on my own 2 feet. And I'm taking charge of my own life, and that's okay. That's great.
When you were young, I know it was like this for me. When I was young and I saw a woman who lost her husband, I thought, well, that's it. Life is over.
It's not over, but there are many, many changes, as every divorcee knows, as every woman...
was that your feeling, though, when you were young? I mean, is that something you had to unlearn?
I never thought about it. When I was young, you never looked at anyone and said, oh, poor thing. You just never thought about it.
Yeah.
You thought, well, Aunt so-and-so lost her husband. You know, she'll come to a wedding and dance with another woman. And that was that. But it's very hard to suddenly be a single. It's a double-digit society. Everybody is a couple. And it's very hard to go out there alone.
Joan Rivers, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, a pleasure talking with you.
And Joan Rivers has written a new memoir. It's called Still Talking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.